Good morning, everybody. We're going to get started, and for those who are still getting breakfast, continue to enjoy. Last week, we spoke about a couple of issues. Number one, we spoke about the issue of tefillah b'tzibur and the importance of davening with a minyan. We spoke also about the difference between a minyan kavua and a minyan she'eino kavua, and when that would play out lahalacha, about having a minyan that meets every week regularly, or having a minyan that only meets on occasion. If you have a minyan that only meets on occasion, one would not recite the bracha achas me'ein sheva on Friday evening. You would not say the chazaras hashatz, the quasi chazaras hashatz that we recite on Friday night. And the third thing we spoke about is hadlakas neir shabbos in a hotel. What's the proper way to do that? And how should one fulfill his obligation of hadlakas neir shabbos? That's what we discussed last week. Now let's move a little bit further. Oftentimes when we go away on vacation, we have issues that arise regarding amir la'akum. Now, amir la'akum obviously is an issue that exists when we're home as well. And we're not going to get into all the details of Amir La'akam because that's a shir in itself. I just want to give certain highlights and a brief overview to suggest something that comes up on a vacation that's very important. Just by way of introduction, Amir La'akam, there are three reasons that are given in the Rishonim about why the Isser Amir La'akam was instituted. It's obviously an Isser Midrabanan. I didn't say that correctly. It's not obviously an Isser Midrabanan. There is one opinion who says Amir La'akam is an Isser Daraisa. We don't hold like that. We assume it's an Isser Midrabanan. And the question is, why did the Chazal institute this violation of Amir La'akum, of asking a non-Jew to do something on our behalf on Shabbos? What's the problem? The non-Jew is not mitzvah on Shabbos. Nobody told him that he has to keep Shabbos, so why can't we ask him to do a malacha for us on Shabbos as well? This is, surprisingly enough, this is a machlokas, the Rambam, Rashi, and Rashi. So usually when you have a three-way machlokas, it should be three opinions of three different people. Over here you have three opinions, but it's only two people speaking. So the Rambam says as follows. The Rambam writes in Perek Vav Hilchos Shabbos Halacha Aleph, Asur lomer l'nachri lasas lona malacha b'Shabbos. We are not allowed to ask a non-Jew to perform any malacha for us on Shabbos. Af al pi she'eino mitzuva ala Shabbos. Nowhere does it say that a non-Jew has to keep Shabbos, and for that matter, a non-Jew is not even allowed to keep Shabbos. It says, Nachri she'Shabbos, a non-Jew who chooses to observe Shabbos, chayiv misa. So he's not allowed to keep Shabbos at all. Afal pisha amar lo mikodem haShabbos. Now the Rambam highlights for us, even if you ask the non-Jew before Shabbos comes in, before the onset of Shabbos, and I go to him and I say, I want you tonight to turn the lights on at this and this time, I want you to make sure the air conditioner is on at this and this time, that is also a violation of Amir La'akam, even though I'm not doing anything on Shabbos proper. I'm doing all of the instruction before Shabbos comes in. Va'afal pisha eno tzorach la'osa malacha ela la'achar haShabbos. Or let's say I ask the non-Jew to do something for me, and I don't need that until after Shabbos. Still, says the Rambam, that's going to be a violation. Says the Rambam, this is a violation, midrabanan, it's not a biblical prohibition. Why? Kidei shalotiyah Shabbos kala be'enehem. That Shabbos shouldn't be treated lightly in our eyes. V'yavo lasos ba'atzma. What's going to happen? We're going to spend the whole Shabbos telling a non-Jew to do everything. So we're going to have a non-Jew walking behind us, and we're going to say, please turn on the lights, please drive my car, please do this, please do that. After a while, Shabbos is going to become so kal be'enenu, it's going to become so unimportant. We're not really going to appreciate the halachas of Shabbos, because everything we want, we're just going to ask the non-Jew to do, and then after a while, we're going to come to do the malacha on our own. So therefore, says the Rambam, this is the reason why the Chachamim saw that it was important to institute this idea that Amir al-Nachri is not permissible on Shabbos, in order that we shouldn't come to do it on our own. The second reason that's given is Rashi in Masechah Shabbos, Daf Kufnun Gimel Amad Aleph. Rashi tells us that the reason they instituted this Isser of Amir al-Akam on Shabbos is because Mipnei Shanasi Shanase HaNachri Kishlucha, because the non-Jew becomes like my Shaliach, and therefore the same way I am not allowed to be Mechal Shabbos, so too I'm not allowed to have my Shaliach be Mechal Shabbos for me. So therefore, a non-Jew is not allowed to do that. Don't we know the Gemara says, Atem l'rabash luchachem, the Gemara says in Kiddushin, a non-Jew cannot be considered a shaliach on my behalf. Don't we know, if let's say I want to be mekadesh anisha, if I want to go ahead and get married, I don't have to give her the ring on my own. I can send somebody on my behalf to be mekadesh the isha for me, to give her the ring on my behalf and say, Hareya mekudeshes to him over there who sent me as the shaliach on his behalf to make you his wife. So why is it over here, the Gemara says over there, that you cannot send a non-Jew to be your shaliach? Atem l'rabash luchacha means the shaliach has to be on the same level as you are. A Jew can only be a shaliach for another Jew. So why is it over here that all of a sudden a non-Jew can serve as a shaliach on behalf of a Jew, if generally the halacha is not so? Rashi says, because yesh shlichas la'akum l'chumra midrabanan. Says Rashi, yes, it's true that generally we assume a non-Jew cannot serve as a shliach for a Jew. However, l'chumra, when we're talking about l'chumra over here, with regard to violating Hilchos Shabbos, Rashi says, we would break the rule and we would say that even a non-Jew can serve as a shliach. So that's reason number two. You're not allowed to send a non-Jew as your shliach because we assume that that will be as if you are violating Shabbos on your own, the same way if you sent a shliach to be Mekadesh, a woman for you, he would be able to do it for you. Reason number three that Rashi writes in Avodah Zarah is because we have a pasuk in Sefer Yeshaya that says, Mimtso chepsecha v'dabra dabra. There's a certain way that we're supposed to do about our activity on Shabbos, a certain way we're supposed to speak on Shabbos. It should be a different speech than we have during the week, a different way of activity than we have during the week. And therefore we assume that dabra dabra includes that you shouldn't talk about malacha either. The same way, on Shabbos we're not supposed to talk about all the businesses that we do during the week. So too on Shabbos we're not supposed to talk about malacha, and therefore we shouldn't ask another to do malacha for us. So these are the three reasons. The question is, why do we need all these reasons? Shouldn't one of them suffice? That's a big discussion in the Stipler that he has on Masechah Shabbos. But we don't have time for that right now because we're trying to cover a couple of different points this morning. What's interesting to note and very important to know is the Gemara Bava Metzia Daf Tzadi, where the Gemara says, don't mistakenly think that this violation of Amir Lenachri only applies to Hilchos Shabbos. The Gemara there tells us that we extend it to other halachas as well. Which other halachas do we extend it to? Is a big, big machlokas, but the Gemara certainly gives two instances where we for sure know that Amir La'akam applies, and one of them is very commonly asked about and very not well known enough. The Gemara talks about the violation of Siris HaBehema. One is not allowed to neuter an animal. Now, nowadays we know that neutering an animal helps very much in order to tame the animal, but that is a violation, a biblical violation. You're not allowed to neuter an animal. Says the Gemara, yes, I don't know how to neuter an animal. I happen not to be a veterinarian. I'm not a doctor. I don't know how to do it. What if I'm going to bring it to somebody else to do it on my behalf? So that's the violation of Amir Lenachri. I'm going to ask a non-Jew. Obviously, the same way I'm not allowed to neuter my animal, I'm not allowed to ask another Jew to neuter the animal. What if I ask a non-Jew to neuter my animal? Says the Gemara, that is a violation of Amir Lenachri on the Isser of Siris HaBehema. So again, the Gemara says clearly, that's the example that the Gemara gives for Amir Lenachri by Shar Isurim. Whether or not we extend it to all the Isurim in the Torah is a question, but neutering an animal is a very serious shaila. It's a very big problem. In fact, here, somebody asked recently about neutering an animal. One is not allowed to do it, and one is not allowed to ask a non-Jew to do it either. The question is, can I sell the animal to somebody else and have the other person do it after I sell it? Big question, but the question that was raised here I thought was an interesting twist to the whole shaila. It's a somewhat of a new shaila for those who know a little bit about this. That nowadays they have an injection, that they don't have to do anything physically to the animal. It used to be neutering, they had to actually mutilate the animal. But nowadays, they can just do an injection and that will take care, that will get to the same result as doing anything that will mutilate the body itself. So the question was raised, is one allowed to do that injection instead of doing a physical mutilation? Can I actually have the injection done instead? Will that be good enough? Will that be the same Isser of Siris HaBehema or not? So my father felt that it was exactly the same way that we find by a human being, if they choose to take kosh shel akar, and the Gemara says, if you choose to drink something that's going to make you no longer be able to be fertile, no longer be able to have children, that would be a violation of Siris as well. If a man or a woman takes that, that would be the same violation, perhaps not punishable with the same punishment, but it is the same violation, midaraisa. So my father thought that was the same by neutering an animal as well. So this is a very important thing to know about. So anyway, when we talk about Hilchos Shabbos, Amir La'akam is a very important concept, and it's something that we need to keep in mind. What about if you're able to do something that can be done either in a way which is mutter or a way which is aser? For example, many of us might have a cleaning lady that comes to the house on Shabbos and you ask the cleaning lady to wash the dishes. Obviously, they're going to turn on the hot water and they're going to violate the malacha of Bishul B'Shabbos. So shouldn't that be a violation of Amir La'akum? I asked the woman to go and clean the dishes. I know that she's going to turn on the hot water. I also know that she's going to use a sponge. And that sponge she's going to squeeze out. That's a malacha of Schita. That's obviously something that we would try not to do on Shabbos, so why am I allowed to ask the non-Jew to do it for me? So this is the question that is always asked, and the reason why that's permissible, it's absolutely permissible, is because it's very easy for the non-Jew to do it in a way which is mutter. For example, if the non-Jew will wash the dishes with water that is cold, the dishes will get clean. Might not be as easy, but the dishes will get clean if they use cold water instead of hot. And therefore, since the malacha can be done in a way which is completely mutter, or for that matter, the non-Jew doesn't have to use a sponge which is so porous, which every time you squeeze it, water is going to come out. They can use something which scrubs and doesn't absorb water. So in a case like that, since a non-Jew could do all of the malacha for you in a way which is not a malacha at all, therefore if they choose on their own to do it with hot water and with a sponge, that's not considered a violation of Amir Lanachri at all. That's what we call Adaita Denavshe Ka'avid. The non-Jew is doing it with their own understanding. They decided that they want to clean the dishes this way. They decided this is the easiest and most efficient way to clean them, even though there was a way to do it without violating malacha. Therefore, we consider that to be no problem of Amir La'akum at all. However, the problem is that it does have to be something which is reasonable. It has to be something which is plausible. For example, often we'll go to a hotel. I remember in the plaza, it comes up in Yerushalayim a lot. The plaza is, 15, 20 flights. So somebody forgot their, I remember I was once there for Shabbos, and the Shabbos elevator didn't work. So people were trying their best, unless it was Cholum Mizukenim, somebody who really couldn't walk, people were trying their best to walk up the flights of steps. Now what happened? Happened to be on the 10th floor, so I'm going to walk up 10 flights. It's a little bit difficult, but that's what I'm going to do. The problem is, I forgot to order a crib before Shabbos, and now I need to order a crib from the lobby. I know that they're going to take the elevator upstairs. So you'll say, what's the problem? That's not a violation of Amir La'akum. They can take the steps up with the crib the same way I can take the steps up when I come back from shul. However, the Achronim point out that it has to be reasonable. Is it reasonable to ever imagine that somebody's going to walk up 10 flights of steps with a crib? Not reasonable. It's reasonable to imagine that maybe the employee of the hotel will walk up 2 flights of steps with a crib. Could be. So therefore, to ask them to come to the 2nd, 3rd, 4th floor maybe with a crib on Shabbos will be fine, even though you're going to know that they're using the elevator. However, to ask them to come up to the 10th or 20th floor, you know that there's no way in the world that they would ever walk up with 10 flights of stairs with a crib in their hand, and therefore, that's something that we have to keep in mind when we go to a hotel, when we have elevated flights, what you're going to ask for. Do you know that the non-Jew is going to violate a malacha in order to bring you what you want? Now, or? What's the shvus? Okay. Amir La'akam on a malacha derabban is also not permissible.
Okay, that's what I'm asking.
Yeah.
So it's malacha? Okay.
Yeah, so you're right. Malacha, I guess I should have said something that we're not allowed to do on Shabbos. Not a malacha deraisa per se. Amir La'akam on a malacha derabban is also not permissible. Correct. So what Rabbi Fink is pointing out is that even though you have, let's say, going in an elevator, so pressing the button might only be a malacha derabbanan because electricity might only be midrabbanan and LED lights is only midrabbanan and all that. Still, we're not allowed to ask the non-Jew to do it for us. So that's something to keep in mind. Now, what about if we're talking about a case where I didn't ask the non-Jew to do it for me? The non-Jew did it on his own? Or an action was done on my behalf. So am I allowed to gain any benefit, any pleasure from the activity that was done? For example, the Mishnah writes in Maseches Shabbos, if you have a non-Jew that lights a candle for himself, he has no intention of helping me out at all. He does it for himself. The Jew is allowed to get benefit, gain pleasure, and use that light on Shabbos. However, in Bishvil HaYisrael, if the Nachri walks into the room and he says, oh wow, look, I forgot to turn the lights on, and he goes and he turns the lights on, the Gemara says we are not allowed to derive any benefit, any pleasure from the malacha that the non-Jew does for us on Shabbos. Now, this is a very important halacha. This is quoted in Shulchan Aruch, and the Mishnah Berurah talks about it, and the Shulchan Aruch himself talks about it in Siman Tav Kuf Tes Vav in Aruch Chaim. And there's a discussion in the Rishonim why we are not allowed to derive benefit from a malacha that's done via a non-Jew on Shabbos. Rashi writes as follows. Rashi says the reason why is a separate halacha, Kedei Shelo Yehena Mimalacha V'Shabbos. A malacha was performed on Shabbos. You're not supposed to do a malacha on Shabbos. And you're not supposed to ask a non-Jew to do a malacha for you on Shabbos. Therefore, Rashi says, by extension, the Chachamim made a violation that if a malacha was performed on Shabbos, we make sure that you're not going to derive any benefit from it. And that's the reason why a Nachri Sha'asa B'Shvil Yisrael, we cannot derive benefit from it. It's a separate din. Tosfos says, no, that's not the reason. Tosfos says the reason why is because maybe next week, Shemi Yavakish Me'a Nachri. Maybe next week you saw it worked so well, so now you're going to go and ask the non-Jew outright. You're going to ask him to do the malacha for you. And because we don't want you to come to violate the malacha of Amir, the Isra of Amir La'akum, therefore we say even if he does it on his own, but if he does it for you intentionally, then you are not allowed to derive any benefit. What's the difference if you think the reason is because just a separate din, Shelo Yenemi Malacha Shabbos, or it's because we're afraid that you're going to come to ask him? Difference is, the nafkamina that they give is, let's say, on Yom Tov Sheni. So again, let's say you have a non-Jew does a malacha for you on the first day of Yom Tov. Question is, am I able to derive benefit or pleasure from it on the second day of Yom Tov? Well, If the reason why is Kadesh lo yena mimelechas yamtif, well, when it comes to our case of yamtif sheni, Rashi would say that it's permissible. Why? Because once the second day of yamtif comes around, memadav shach, either today is yamtif or yesterday was yamtif. Both days are not really yamtif, so therefore it's not considered a violation of shelo yena mimelechas Shabbos. However, according to Tosus, that says the reason why you can't derive any benefit from a malacha that was done by a non-Jew on Shabbos is because we're concerned, Shema Yevakesh Mehanachri, maybe you're going to ask him next week to do it outright. Well, then on Yom Tov Sheni, you wouldn't be allowed to derive benefit from it either, because on Yom Tov Sheni, you're not allowed to ask him to do malacha the same way you're not allowed to ask him on Yom Tov Rishon. So that's the nafkamina that's given. In Shulchan Aruch, there's a machlokas, the Mechaber and the Rama. How do we paskin on this? So the Rama is Mekel. I'm sorry, the Rama says, the Mechaber is Mekel, the Rama is Machmer like Tosus, which means that the reason, what you see from the Rama is that we assume that the reason why, we meaning Ashkenazim assume, that the reason why one is not allowed to derive benefit from a malacha that's done by a non-Jew on Shabbos is because we're concerned, Shema Yevakesh Mehanachri Sheyasa B'Shvila, we're concerned. If you saw it worked so well, the next week you're going to go and ask him outright to do the malacha on your behalf. And that's why we are not allowed to derive benefit from it. So what about when we're not talking about an actual malacha that was performed? Let's say, for example, a non-Jew brings something from outside of the tchum. It's not really a malacha. He didn't go and cook food for me. He didn't turn the lights on. So he's just traveling in a Rishus HaRabim, let's say. I'm not allowed to carry something outside. Is that really a malacha? So what if the non-Jew, he doesn't create anything, and he doesn't cook anything, and he doesn't turn the lights on, but he carries something in a Rishus HaRabim? Or he drives, I guess driving is a malacha, but somebody drives him, and he comes from outside of the tchum, and he brings me something from outside of the tchum. Let's say, for example, it happens every once in a while, much to our dismay. I land on a Friday afternoon in wherever it might be, and everything's wonderful, except my luggage has not arrived. So what do? So my luggage hasn't come. So they give me a voucher, and they say, go quickly and buy everything you need, and spend the $150, spend the $200. They don't know that in $200 you can't buy anything nowadays. Okay, but that's what it is. Then they send me a message on Friday afternoon, by this evening, don't worry, we promise you we'll have the suitcase, we're going to send somebody to bring it to your house. Well, very nice. They deliver the suitcase Friday night. Question is, can I actually use anything that's in the suitcase on Shabbos? Why not? Did anyone do any malacha? They didn't create my stuff. They didn't create the suitcase. All they did was, they took it from the conveyor belt where they found it, they sent it in a taxi, and now they brought it to my house. Well, am I allowed to use that or not? That is a major question. So let's look at the Gemara says in Masechta Shabbos, Kuvchav Bezim Adalef. In Mile Mayim, let's say a non-Jew fills up a bucket of water. Back in the days when they used to have water carriers, they used to fill up buckets of water. So you have somebody who fills up a bucket of water, Vehevio Derech Rishus HaRabim, and he goes through the Rishus HaRabim, which is not permissible on Shabbos, and he brings the water, he delivers it to the Jew. Aser Li Yisrael Lehanes Mimenim. The Jew is not allowed to use that water. Why? Why is that? Because the non-Jew violated a malacha in order to provide the water for the Jew. The obvious question is as follows. Let's say the Gemara discusses in Maseches Gittin a very important halacha. What if I forget that it's Shabbos or whatever it is, I turn on the fire, I cook up a soup on Shabbos. Then I realize, Ave, what did I do? Totally forgot about the malacha. Says the Gemara, Yisrael Sha'asa, if a Jew does it, so I'm not allowed to derive any pleasure, any benefit from the malacha that a Jew did. However, what happens if the Jew mistakenly carries something through Rishus HaRabim on Shabbos, or the Jew mistakenly goes chutz l'tchum with something on Shabbos and delivers it to his friend? What's the halacha there? You are allowed to derive pleasure and benefit from that. Again, if a Jew cooks up a soup on Shabbos, does a real malacha on Shabbos, then we're not allowed to have pleasure benefit from it. After Shabbos is a big question. But on Shabbos proper, you're not allowed to derive benefit from it. What about if a Jew just carries something chutz l'tchum, or a Jew carries something in Rishus HaRabim and brings it to shul? So should you be allowed to derive benefit or pleasure from that or not? Let's say I walk outside with a box of tissues. I don't realize that there's no air. If I come to shul, I put it down on the table, everyone wants to use it. Well, I did a malacha, some sort of malacha. So the Rashba writes that no. If a Jew cooks something on Shabbos, since he created something through the cooking, since he generated a new entity that was never here before, that is not permissible to use on Shabbos. But if the Jew just carried something in the Rishus HaRabim, okay, he violated an Isser. But that's not going to create the box of tissues and make it not permissible for anybody to use anymore. So that's the way the Rashba understands. Well, if that's true, if a Jew violates an Isser on Shabbos, we assume if he carries Chutz L'Tchum, you're allowed to use it. So then how could it be that if a non-Jew carry something chutz l'tchum on Shabbos, how can that be more chomer than if a Jew does it? How does that make sense? Again, the Mishnah that we just quoted in Maseches Shabbos Kuchav Beis tells us, if a non-Jew carries something mechutz l'tchum, he brings the water carrier, brings the water to my house on Shabbos, even though he didn't generate the water, he didn't create it, but he just carried it through Rishus HaRabim. We assume that the Jew is not allowed to derive benefit from it on Shabbos. How can that be? How can it be that the halacha is that a non-Jew's Isser on Shabbos, which is not even an Isser, is more chamer than if a Jew did it on Shabbos? How can that be? So the answer that the Rishonim give is as follows. It's counterintuitive. It doesn't really make sense. It's backward. Should have said that a Jew who does malach on Shabbos is much worse than a non-Jew. So the answer is as follows. The Achronim explain the reason why is because since we're concerned if a non-Jew does something for you, we're concerned you're going to ask him next week to do it for you. If the water carrier brings water to your house and he carried it through Rishus HaRabim. So you see, it's a good arrangement that you have with him. So next week you're going to go outright and you're going to ask him to do it for you. So that's a violation of Amira L'Nachri on Shabbos, which one would not be allowed to do. And since we're concerned that you're going to ask him next week, therefore we say, you know what, you're not allowed to use the water at all, even though he didn't create the water, he didn't generate anything new, it's not like cooking up a soup, but still we say by a non-Jew you have to be machmir and you're not allowed to derive benefit from what he did. However, when you talk about a Jew who does that on Shabbos, let's say a Jew carries a box of tissues, I would never think to ask him next week to do it for me, he made a mistake. I'm not going to ask him to say, oh, please be machal Shabbos for me because he did such a good job last week, please do it again. I would never ask for such a thing, and therefore we assume, even though it's counterintuitive, it sounds a little strange, it's backwards, that we would be more machmer for the malacha done by a non-Jew, which he's allowed to do, still, this is the understanding that we have. Yeah?
In the case of the suitcase, you're still going to pull before Shabbos.
Okay.
On Shabbos, you're like hiring anyone before Shabbos. There's no Isra with that, but is that any different?
Sure there is. What do you mean?
You're basically hiring someone, well, your ticket basically paid for services, including the suitcase, right?
Correct.
So the suitcase didn't come on time, so you're still for the pull before Shabbos. Is burning it on Shabbos. Why is it different than any other malacha that a nachman would do for you on Shabbos?
Would not be permissible.
You're paying for him before Shabbos.
Would not be permissible.
Or babysitting anything like that.
What malacha is the babysitter doing for you on Shabbos?
Warming up a baby bottle.
That's...
He could have also brought it after Shabbos. He chose
1 second. No. If the flight tells you, if the airline tells you we're going to bring it on Shabbos, so then, you know, they have to bring it on Shabbos, otherwise you'll sue them. So if we're talking about your story where they had an option to bring it in a 2-day span, that's like bringing my shirts to the dry cleaners and I know that maybe they'll do it on Shabbos, maybe they won't. That's a daita and an option. That's their choice to do it that way. That's not a problem at all. Now, with regard to your question, that's what the Rambam said. That's why I read the Rambam. Let's read it again just to make it clear. I'm not allowed to ask a non-Jew to do malacha for me on Shabbos. Even if, says the Rambam, even if I ask him before Shabbos, I make all the arrangements, says the Rambam, and on Shabbos I don't say a word to him. I don't even see him. But he does all the malacha for me on Shabbos, and I set up the whole system before and I left him instructions. Still, says the Rambam, that's a violation of Amir La'akam on Shabbos. So that's something that we have to keep in mind. Something a lot of people don't know. They think that just because you set everything up in a system before Shabbos, they think that that's good enough. Now, this leads to the next question, what about mail that comes on Shabbos? The same way the water carrier, we're not allowed to use the water, what about the mail that comes on Shabbos? And what about, for that matter, the newspaper that comes on Shabbos? So how are we allowed to have any benefit from that? The answer is we're not. So one is not allowed, we consider that to be muktzah. You're not allowed to touch the newspaper that comes on Shabbos. Why? Because we assume that it came mechutz l'tchum, and since it, what? So nolad is an interesting question. Nolad is an interesting question, but leaving that out for a second, because the question about nolad on Shabbos and Yontif gets a little more complicated, but certainly just simple muktzah, since we assume that the same way the water carrier who brings the water michutz l'tchum, you're not allowed to derive benefit, so too over here, if the non-Jew does a malacha and brings your newspaper on Shabbos to you, we assume that you are not allowed to derive benefit. However, there's a big difference that's drawn between the newspaper that comes on Shabbos and a letter that comes on Shabbos. Shulchan Aruch says in Siman Shin Zayin that if a letter comes to your house on Shabbos, so you're allowed to, meaning you're not sure if it's a check, you don't know what it is, so it might be muktzah, you can't open it up. However, he says you're allowed to ask a non-Jew to open it for you, and you're allowed to read it on Shabbos. What do you mean, but I'm getting hanah from that on Shabbos? Isn't that the same as using the water that the non-Jew brought for me? So the Shulchan Aruch says no, based on Rabbeinu Tam. Shulchan Aruch says because so often we get letters that are pikuach nefesh, that are real, life-threatening letters, so therefore you have to ask the non-Jew to open it for you because you never know what's going to be in there. Come on. So nowadays, what? You can't act on it anyway on Shabbos. What do you mean? If it's real pikuach nefesh, sure you can. So that's what Rabbeinu Tam says, because every once in a while you're going to have a letter that's real pikuach nefesh. So the later Achronim say, well, nowadays, if there was a real pikuach nefesh, they wouldn't send you a letter in the mail. They would call you on the phone, they would knock on your door, the FBI would come. If they really needed you, they would come knock on the door. And if they're sending you a letter, it means it could wait till after Shabbos anyway. So that whole heter is a little bit out the window. However, there is a major difference between why that's not considered to be nena mimelech Shabbos and a newspaper would be. Because the newspaper, I subscribed. I asked the non-Jew to send it to me on Shabbos. So therefore we assume that's the same as asking somebody, the water carrier, to bring the water for you. He's violating melacha for you on Shabbos. That's not permissible to get benefit or pleasure from it. However, when somebody sends you a letter, there's no way that I can ask the mailman to ask all of my friends to send me letters. Right? It just doesn't make sense. Somebody else has to decide to send me a letter. And therefore, in a case like that, we don't assume that this violation of Nana Mimelecha Shabbos applies. That's why if the non-Jew happens to open it for me, he's allowed to read it for me, even though I'm going to get benefit from the fact that he's reading it. Yeah?
So when you order something now with guaranteed delivery, it's not possible for it to be delivered if it wasn't shipped on Shabbos, right? Like you order something on Friday for Monday delivery, Sunday delivery.
Mm-hmm.
The only way it's possible for it to be delivered by that day is if they do stuff on Shabbos.
So again, it's not such a thing as overnight delivery.
If they could have sat in a warehouse over Shabbos and they would have just started shipping it after Shabbos, then that's okay. Mm-hmm.
So I think nowadays that question is not really true, because we do have something called overnight delivery at any time. You happen not to have paid for it, but they really could do it. So again, you don't know what they're actually doing on Shabbos and what they're not. You pay that it should be here for sure by Sunday night. Okay? If they really needed to get here by overnight delivery, they would figure out how to do it. So there is a way around it. So again, that might be a daita d'nafshei. That's the guy deciding on their own that they want to do the malacha on Shabbos. It's not that I ask them to do the malacha specifically on Shabbos. But let's say I order something 5 minutes before Shabbos, and I say that I want it to be here by the time Shabbos is over. That's not permissible. That's not permissible. Yeah.
How is that different than going on a boat,
on a cruise
ship?
Mm-hmm. You're saying that you're asking them to do malacha for you on Shabbos?
When I'm buying the cruise a week, 2, a month before,
I don't know. Very good question. Let me. Right. So he's doing it for everyone. No, but what if you have a kosher cruise? What if you have a kosher cruise? Kosher cruise, they stop for Shabbos. Kosher cruise, do they stop for Shabbos or they keep going? What? Ah, kosher cruise doesn't mean the whole place is kosher.
No.
Ah, so then, I thought a kosher cruise means the whole cruise is kosher. Oh, no, so if you're talking about a cruise where you have for a Jew and a non-Jew, no, so he's correct. If you're talking about a cruise where you have a Jew and a non-Jew, so then the malacha is being done equally for both. Again, I'm not allowed to go and ask the person to do the malacha specifically for the Jewish people there. But if you have hundreds of people who are not Jewish on the cruise, and we assume the malacha is being done for them equally as it's being done for us, so then that would be permissible. Now, why? Shh. Yeah?
Mm-hmm. Whether it's 10 people, 20 people, 30 people, 100 people. So it would be less work if they weren't doing it for them.
Okay.
I thought you were going to bring up things that are obviously just very obvious. In other words, I've been on kosher hotels where people are swimming on Shabbos, things like that. So obvious.
Meaning, I'm not done yet.
Oh, okay.
Give me a chance.
I'm watching
the clock. I still have time. We have breakfast and lunch here, so, you know, there's plenty of bagels left. Yeah. The Isser is that the non-Jew, Asur Lahanes Mimelecha Shabbos, that was done on your behalf, and since you subscribed, he's coming Michutz L'Tchum, or he's driving on Shabbos to bring you the thing, so you'll say, well, he's not driving for me, he's driving for the millions of other people who order the newspaper also. But that's not reasonable. Again, that's not reasonable that he's going to bring 500 newspapers on his bicycle. Okay. Okay, so you have to know each situation. You have to know each situation. I would imagine. And you also have the question of Muktzah that it was printed on Shabbos itself. On Shabbos morning. So it's...
So let's say you get the newspapers printed on Shabbos.
Yeah.
You get the newspapers printed on Shabbos.
Yeah.
And in the newspaper, the sections were printed on Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. The sports section, the business section, they were printed on Friday night.
Mm-hmm.
But the rest of it's not.
Is that true? They print the paper at different times? They don't just press print and the whole thing goes?
No.
I don't know. They may have arranged it all before, but did they print that before Shabbos started?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay. So again, it doesn't come in separate pieces either, as far as I understand. Okay, you have to know. Once you start going into that, you really have to... You have to know. Is it really within the tchum? I don't know that that's the case. Every time someone travels on a highway to deliver a newspaper, is it really coming from within the tchum? I don't know. I'm not convinced at all.
Really?
Yeah.
In New York City, you got houses on the sides of every highway. Unless you can tell me you're driving out to Suffolk County.
Okay, so it depends where you live. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Shabbos Kiddush? Yeah. Okay, so what I'm seeing is that we should have another separate shiur about Amir La'akam on Shabbos. No, because the issues that you're raising are very important ones. I just wanted to bring something that comes up on a vacation, but we will hopefully get back to that at another point. Something to be aware of when you, a consideration that we should try and make before we book a hotel is, nowadays in many of the modern hotels, you have the phenomenon that when you walk into the room, the electricity automatically goes on, and your lights go on, and your air conditioning goes on, and the heating is regulated based on the people who are in the room. So you have to think about that beforehand. Automatic regulation, when you walk into the room, that everything is going to be set into motion, that is also considered a questionable thing to do on Shabbos. When it comes to muktzah, so we have an issue when we go to hotels, because most of the hotels that we go to do not accommodate for the Jews to have the actual old-fashioned, old-style keys that we all grew up with. So now they have either the card key, or you have, most hotels are moving on from that, you have a fob now, you have that, whatever, electronic key, whatever it is, that they give you to get into your room. So the question is, obviously you're not allowed to use that on Shabbos because that would be closing a circuit, that would be generating electricity on Shabbos, and one is not allowed to do that. The question was raised, are you allowed to carry it in your pocket? Let's say sometimes when you have a Jewish program that takes over a hotel, so they'll be very machmir, and they'll have a non-Jew on each floor that allows, you know, that's going to help everybody to get into their rooms. So am I allowed to carry my card key? I'm not going to use it, but can I give it to the non-Jew that he should use it in my room? So that's a question. Is that card key considered muktzah or not? So you have to know there are four categories of muktzah that the Mishnah Berurah sets out in his Hakdamah, in his introduction. So that's a question. Why are you allowed to do that in the first place, to ask the non-Jew? You have to set it up in the right way. But however the hotel set it up, that you won't violate Amir La'akum. You do a piramiza, whatever it is. But the question is, can I hold my key around and give it to that person in order for him to be able to open the door for me? So this is a big question. This is a question that the OU wrote extensively about, because the OU was asked, are they allowed to give a hashgacha to a hotel that doesn't really accommodate for people to be able to have regular old-style keys? So this is a major question. So the Mishnah Berurah writes there are four categories of muktzah on Shabbos. Category number one is what he calls the most serious, the most severe category of muktzah, and that is muktzah machmas chisaron kis. For example, I have a fancy violin, a Stradivarius, and now I'm concerned that on Shabbos that's nobody should touch it, nobody should use it, we're concerned that it's going to break, it's going to get ruined, the kids are going to ruin it, and therefore we assume that's called muktzah machmas chisaron kis. I don't want anyone to touch it because it's so expensive, and I'm afraid someone's going to destroy it, someone's going to ruin it, therefore I assume something like that is not permissible to bring either, even letzarech gufo, letzarech makomo, even if I need it on Shabbos for something, meaning I'm going to use the violin to get something from a top shelf that I can't reach, probably not so... No, not. You can think of a better example. But even if it's a tzorach gufa or the tzorach makoma, I left the violin in the middle of the table, and now how can I set the Shabbos table with the violin in the middle? Tzorach makoma, still, I'm not allowed to move that on Shabbos. That's called muchtza machmas chisaron kis. I'm not allowed to move that at all. Then you have the second category that the Mishnah Berurah says is something which has no use on Shabbos. For example, eitzim va'avanim v'yafer. If you have dirt, you have rocks, you have pebbles, they have no use on Shabbos at all. We're not going to do anything with them. Something like that is the second item of the second category of muktzah on Shabbos. The third is a kli shemalachta le'iser. For example, a hammer. There's nothing intrinsically wrong with it. It's just that every time I use a hammer, I always use it for a purpose, which is a malach on Shabbos. I always use it to bang a nail into the wall. So it really has no use on Shabbos. Well, what if I don't have my nutcracker and I want to use the hammer in order to crack the nut on Shabbos? So then that is something which is a kli shemalachta le'iser. And in a kli shemalachta le'iser, we assume that if it's the tzarech gufo, I'm allowed to carry it. So if I need it in order to crack my nut, I'm allowed to use the hammer for that purpose. Now, this is all assuming that you have no other way to crack the nut with something which is permissible. But again, the question is, how far out of your way do you have to go in order to find something else? Mishnah Berurah says you don't have to go so far out of your way. If you can't find readily available, so then forget about it, use the hammer, and that's fine. Then the fourth category of muktzah is a basis. You have something which is permissible. You have a plate on the table that happens to have some coins on it. You have something where you forgot to take the muktzah items off. So that's a basis on Shabbos. So now, when you talk about our case over here about a fob or a electronic key, the question is that really considered a muktzah item, which is muktzah mamish, which is really considered muktzah on its own because it has no purpose on Shabbos? Or do you say, no, that's a klisha malafta le'iser? That's a klisha malafta le'iser because that's the same as a hammer. Every time I use that key, I use it to do a malacha. So is that a klisha malachta le'iser? There's nothing intrinsically muktzah about it, but maybe it's a klisha malachta le'iser, and if a klisha malachta le'iser is carried the tzarech gufo, maybe it's permissible. So Rabbi Belsky in the OU argued that he should have a refuah shlema. He is actually extremely not well these days. I was with my father in the OU this week, and we were sitting in Rabbi Belsky's office, and they told us that he has a very serious condition. So our divrei Torah should be a refuah shlema for him. So Rabbi Belsky said that that's called a klisha malachta le'iser. And therefore, if I want to carry it around and give it to the non-Jew on Shabbos, that would not be a violation at all. And my father vehemently disagreed, and Rabbi Ganak agreed with my father, so that's the way it works there. 2 out of 3, so you're out. So it goes in all directions. So 2 out of 3, whoever the 2 out of 3 is, consensus, they win. So 2 out of 3, Rabbi Ganak and my father both were of the opinion that no, that's not a klisha malachta le'iser. That's not like a hammer that now I want to use for the purpose of cracking a nut. Why am I carrying my key? In order that a non-Jew should do a malacha. That's not like a hammer that now I'm going to use for a purpose which is mutter. It's like something which is only used for an iser, and now I'm going to use it for an iser again. So I'm not allowed to carry that around. That's like muktzah mamish. You're not allowed to carry that around at all. So that was a very important discussion as well with regard to those who are in a hotel for Shabbos. Then, there is a discussion, picking up on your point. I see it's 9:56, but we still have a couple of minutes. About exercising on Shabbos. Exercising on Shabbos is something which is relevant at home as well, but it's worth thinking about at this time of year. In the Maseches Shabbos Kuf Yud Gimel, the Gemara says, "V'chibadat al me'asos derachecha mimtza chefzecha v'daber daber." Says the Gemara, "Shelo yehi hiluchach shel Shabbos ki hiluchach shel chol." One should not do the same activities on Shabbos as they would do during the week. Says the Gemara in Brachos, it takes it even further. The Gemara says, Amar Abzeira, Meireish, in the beginning, when I used to see the Talmidim running through the streets to the Shir, or to the Beis Medrash, or to the davening on Shabbos, I would say, Amina, Kamachaylim Rabbana Shabbata. I would say, what's wrong with these guys? How are they running on Shabbos? You're not allowed to run on Shabbos. That's Chilul Shabbos. Wow. And then he says, given the Shamana, once I heard that they're running to go to the Shir and go to the Beis Medrash, I said, okay, so they're allowed to do it for that. So it seems that the Gemara tells us this is a Isser Derabbanan on Shabbos to do exercise because it's called hit amlut. If you're ever looking in the modern day svarim, the Shmir Shabbos Kilchas or anything else, the way to look it up is when he has the word hit amlut, which means exercising on Shabbos. So there, they discuss, based on this Gemara, that we assume that exercising on Shabbos would not be permissible because it's a violation of v'chibadatom me'asos terachecha. There's a different way that we're supposed to act on Shabbos than we are during the week. However, there is one major heter that we all should be aware of, and that is the Tosefta Maseches Shabbos, which is quoted in Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch and Simon Shin Aleph tells us, Avam Mitayel Kedarko Afilu Kal Hayam Kulo. The Shulchan Aruch tells us that even though my doctor tells me I have to take an hour walk every day, I have to take a half hour walk every day, so on Shabbos I'm doing it really for my own health. I'm doing it not because I love to walk, I'm doing it because it's for health, it's for exercise. But if metayel kedarko, if you're not jogging, if you're not doing exercise, rather you're just walking the same way everybody else would walk. It happens to be you really despise the activity of walking. You don't like it at all, and it's not something that you enjoy at all. You just happen to do it because the doctor said you have to, and you are making sure that you're staying fit. So if you're doing metayel kedarko, if you're doing exercise in a way which doesn't look anything out of ordinary, then we would assume that that's not called a violation of exercising on Shabbos at all, and that would be fine. Let's get into a couple of minutes about koshering different items when you go away to either a hotel or sometimes nowadays that you'll rent a home, and there are many shilas that are asked about koshering different items in the house and whether or not we can use them. Yeah.
Can you repeat the first one about if you don't do it during the week? What was that?
What you just about said? Exercising?
Yeah.
So again, let's say I really don't enjoy walking at all, and the only reason why I'm walking right now is because my doctor told me.
The one before then, if you don't do something during the week, you can't do it on Shabbos.
V'chibadat me'asos derachecha?
What
Okay, so the Gemara says Shelo yehi hiluchal shachol ki hiluchal shel Shabbos. The Gemara says you should not have the same activity that you normally would do during the week. That should not be done on Shabbos.
So a couch potato could exercise all day Shabbos?
What do you mean?
A couch potato all week, they could exercise all day Shabbos.
Okay. The Shulchan Aruch never imagined that there are people who are couch potatoes. Come on.
We're realists.
No, but there's no such thing. There's no such thing as a Jew as a couch potato. We don't have such things.
Are you kidding me?
No, they're not, you know.
They're
No, they're really doing very important things. You just see them sitting on the couch, but they're really doing very important things. I can't imagine such a thing. The Vilna Gaon writes that there's no such thing as somebody who's staying steady. Either you're going up or you're going down. So somebody who's just sitting on the couch, I don't know. That's not the life of a Jew. It doesn't sound like the life of a Jew.
I wish you were right.
Hopefully, Noose, I have work to do. Okay. So often people, we go to a hotel, and the question that's asked very often is about a Keurig machine, or about, let's say I rent a house and I want to use the oven, I want to cook certain things, so how do I kosher the oven, how do I kosher the microwave? These are very important halachas to be aware of. So, number one, a common misconception is people think, as long as I'm using something which is cold and I'm not doing anything hot, I'm allowed to use treifa kelim. I can use the kelim, I'm allowed to use the plates, because I'm not doing anything hot on that. The Ramah says that is absolutely incorrect. The Ramah says in Arachaim, Hilchas Pesach, Siman Taf Nun Aleph, quotes from the Mordechai, that any kli that is not kosher, and you would have to kosher it in order for it to become kosher, you are not even to be allowed to be mishtamish with it bitsonin. You're not allowed to use it even to cut up your apple and eat your apple off that plate. You're not allowed to do that. Why? What? 1 second. Dechayshinan dilma asi lehishtamish babachamin. You're asking, why is the Ramah say it in Hilchas Pesach? Why doesn't he say it everywhere else? So the answer is because the Ramah only discusses in Arachayim Yerodeya issues in Hilchas Pesach. So that's where he has all of kashering, even though kashering is relevant to the whole year. And even though some of this is relevant to the whole year, that's where the Ramah chose to put everything. But we assume that that applies to during the year as well, not only to Pesach. Then the Ramah qualifies it a little bit in Yerodeya. And he says the whole story is not found in Siman Tafnun Aleph in Hilchas Pesach. The other half of the story is found in Yerodeya and Siman Kuf Chaf Aleph. And over there, the Ramah tells us, well, it's true you're not allowed to use the treifa kelim because we're concerned maybe you're going to use them even for something hot, and that's going to be a real problem. However, the Ramah says this is only if you're using them ba'ofen kavua. This is only if you move into a house and you come in and there's a set of treifa kelim. So you say, well, I'll leave this set of dishes for the cold things, and then I'll buy a new set of dishes for the hot things. The Ramah says, no, that's not a good idea because you're going to end up mixing it up, you're going to make a mistake, and you're going to use it for hot. However, says the Ramah, what if it's derech harai? One time I happen to come visit a non-Jew's home and he cuts me up an apple, he serves it to me on a plate. Okay, what do I know? What did he serve on this plate beforehand? I have no idea. It's probably a treifa plate. But still, the Ramah says, I assume that that would be permissible. That's considered derech harai, and to use it once or twice is not a problem at all, as long as you're not using it in a regular way. As long as you're not using it on a daily basis or on a weekly basis, that would be considered something that is only derech harai. What about when you deal with something hot and you really have to kosher it? So how do you go about the koshering process for that? So we have a principle which is kibalo kach polto, which means the same way that the infusion of taste came into this vessel, into this item, that's the way to get it out. So for example, I baked in my oven by turning the oven on. The only way to kosher that oven, if it was baked or cooked with a non-Jew's tray for cooking in there, we assume the only way to kosher it is to self-clean the oven, to make it really, really hot. The first thing you have to do is make sure there's no residue on the sides of the oven. So you have to clean the oven out really well. Once that's taken care of, then you run a self-cleaning cycle, and then the oven is kosher, and you can go ahead and use the oven. So that's fairly simple. Now, what happens when you want to kosher a glass stovetop, which is becoming more and more prevalent in many homes? This is a big problem. We just moved into a home. We have a glass stovetop, and we bought from a non-Jew. So the assumption is that it's treif. And the question is there any way to kosher a glass stovetop? The answer is no. The mazel is that our people who we bought from had a glass stovetop, but there are two different types of glass stovetops. So one type of glass stovetop that you have nowadays, which is very unsafe, by the way, if you have small children, is that it's just a flat sheet on the counter without anything that comes up. I don't know what, without any burners, right? So everything is just on the surface. So something like that is impossible to kosher. Why? Because you can never get the surface hot enough. I'll turn on all the flames and I'll make it burning hot, right? So what's the concern? Concern is, the Shulchan Aruch assumes that any time you have a consideration of chayshi dilma paki, let's say I have a pot that becomes treif, and it's the kind of pot that's glass, or it's something that's very easy to break. So the Gemara assumes that it's very hard to kasha. You can't really kasha that. Why? Because you're never going to allow it to get hot enough because you're always going to be concerned, well, maybe it's going to crack. So then you're not going to do a good kashering process. So therefore we assume something like that can never be kashered. So too over here. Because the glass stovetop can never get hot enough, and if you turn on all the burners and make it boiling hot, still you're going to be concerned. Once you see that, oh, it's getting too hot, you're going to turn it off right away. So we're concerned that you really can't kasher that. Now, the mazel was that our glass stovetop has burners on top. So the middle of the glass stovetop is treif. The glass part of it is treif. So if something falls on that, we throw it out. But the burners, you can kasher. The burners we put into a self-cleaning cycle in the oven, and we kasher the burners, we burnt them out, and that's fine. That's able to be kashered. So that's with regard to koshering a glass stovetop. There were those who said that you can take a glass stovetop, put a big tent over it of aluminum foil, turn on all the flames, and then it will get burning hot. Doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? Number one, because it will crack. I did it as well. We put a blech on top, not realizing that if it generates too much heat, it's going to crack. Our glass stovetop, which was beautiful, is now cracked. So not a good idea. Don't try it at home. And even if you're going to leave it for only 5 minutes, then you're back to the first consideration, that it's not a good idea to do that, because the Shulchan Aruch says any item, any utensil where you're concerned that maybe you're not going to let it get hot enough because you're so worried that maybe it's going to break, you can kasher that. So therefore the assumption, the working assumption is that a glass stovetop is very, very difficult to kasher. You look in Shulchan Aruch Siman Taf Nun Aleph if you want to see a little bit more about that consideration. One second, yeah? It's just evidence that you did something very unsafe. It's just evidence that you did something very not safe. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Gotta use the other one. Other stove. What? Hotels is a whole other story. We'll get to that Pesach time, yeah? What was that? You're saying why is it a problem at all? So that's an excellent question. There is a major discussion about the whole assumption of why we ever need a kasher something is because we assume that it's a little bit porous and some of the infusion of taste goes into the walls of the pot. Forget about glass. We know that metal is non-porous now either. My father always says over. When my father was in YU, he took, I think, chemistry with Shmuel Soloveitchik, who was Rav Soloveitchik's younger or older brother. I don't remember which one. Older brother. So Shmuel Soloveitchik was a chemist. He was, I think, a brilliant Talmud Chacham. He was also a chemist. He taught chemistry in YU. So my father took him. So my father was learning Yeridei and the Rav Shir, and they were learning all about koshering the pots. And they got to the discussion about glass, and do you have to kosher glass or not? Well, we know glass is non-porous. But why do we have to kosher it? We assume you have to kosher glass in the first place. If something becomes treif, we don't assume that you are allowed to use it again before you kosher it. So why do you have to kosher glass if we know that it's non-porous? What? So that's the question. How does it even become treif in the first place if it's non-porous? That was the question. So my father went to Shmuel Soloveitchik and he said to him, you're a chemist. Is glass bolea? We're learning about this in Shir. What's the story? So he screamed at him. My father always says it over. You idiot! What do you think? How could glass be bolea? How is it possible? You make an experiment in a lab in a test tube. If the test tube even has one drop infused in it from the experiment that you did yesterday, the whole experiment is going to be off. Right? That's obvious to anybody who knows anything about an experiment. It's true. So obviously, we know that it's not balea, and we know it's not true. But still, we're machmer, we assume that glass is balea, and if a glass thing becomes treif, it's difficult to kasher it. It's very difficult to kasher. So that's the assumption. So, okay, Pesach time we'll discuss. Pesach, we have a lot of chumras, and Pesach, we have a lot of things. Again, it's a difference between kashering for Pesach and kashering for during the year. What about when you want to kasher a microwave? So a microwave, again, we assume that kabalo kachpoto, since the microwave, usually we assume, Rav Moshe writes in the Igros Moshe, that steam is not good enough to kasher. You need to have real burning hot water that's bubbling over. However, if you're going to generate enough steam that it's going to condense and really turn into hot water, like in a microwave, where you have enough steam where when you take something out of the microwave, you have droplets of water on top. So we assume that would be good enough to kosher a microwave. However, so when you're koshering a microwave, this is what you do. You take a bowl of water, put it into the microwave, turn it on for 5 minutes, whatever, and you're going to have tons of steam that's going to go all over the microwave, and that's good enough. First of all, you need to first make sure that the microwave is cleaned out with no residue. After that's done, then you do this. However, you have to do it twice because the place where the bowl was doesn't get koshered again. So you have to do it a second time, move the bowl over, kosher that place a second time. So that's with regard to that. Then the question is, what about koshering a Keurig machine in your hotel room? Now this is something which is also a very important discussion, and with this we will close. There's a discussion in the Rishonim, are you able to kosher with shar mashkim? Can you use other liquids outside of water in order to kosher something and make it usable again after it's been used for treif? So number one, Keurig machines, much to people's dismay, Keurig machines, sometimes you can use a flavor of coffee that is non-kosher. And even though the hotel provides you with certain flavors, you don't always assume that the person is using only the flavors that the hotel provides them. Sometimes a person prefers another flavor and they'll bring it along with them. So you have to be concerned, maybe they used a non-kosher flavor. Or for those of us who work in an office where they have a Keurig machine, this question is asked all the time. How can I ever make a coffee if there are people in my office who probably are using non-kosher flavors the same way I'm using a kosher flavor? So this is a very important question. And how do we kosher a Keurig machine? So, number one, you can run a cycle. So in an office, it's a little more difficult because it never sits for 24 hours without being used. People are always using it all the time. So it's a little bit harder to kosher in an office. But when you're going away in a hotel and you're going to be there and you assume that it hasn't been used in the last 24 hours, either you wait 24 hours because you're there for a few days or something of that nature. So then we assume you can run a cycle of hot water through the machine and that will kosher the machine. Or there are those who discuss running a cycle of kosher coffee, that if you assume that b'dieved, if you do hagala with shar mashkim, if you do the koshering process with other liquids outside of water, we assume b'dieved that would work. Rabbi Kiviger is not sure what exactly means b'dieved. Doesn't mean if I already koshered it and cooked something and now I want to know if I could eat that food, is that b'dieved, or does b'dieved mean I don't have water around, I just want to pop a coffee in, or it's going to look ridiculous in my office, I'm going to sit and pour a cycle of hot water, people are going to look at me like I'm crazy. So it might be easier to just do a cycle of coffee through and then just throw it out and kosher the element that way. So this is this is fairly easy to do, to kosher the Keurig machine. So we would assume that as long as you wait 24 hours from the last time it was used, meaning if you can find out from the hotel when the last time your room was used, or if you wait 24 hours before you use it next, so then we assume certainly you can run a cycle of hot water is the best option, or a second best option is to run a cycle of kosher coffee, and that will be good enough to kosher the Keurig machines. Let's just close with one last final thought, and that is, we have Yosef HaTzadik, when his brothers were leaving him. So Yosef HaTzadik tells his brothers, Al tirguzu baderech, I don't want you to get into any fights, any trouble along the road. As you're traveling home back to your father, go right away, and don't make problems for yourselves on your travel back home. So there are three pshatim that Rashi writes, and I believe all three of these are very relevant to us. Number one, Rashi says, Al tis'aske b'dvar halacha. Don't start talking and learning, meaning you're going to start getting involved in a sugya, talking and learning, paskening shailas, you're going to forget about where you're going, you're going to get lost, and you're not going to pay attention, you're not going to get home as fast as you should. That's pshat number one, Rashi says. Pshat number two, Rashi says, is Al tafsiu psiagase v'achnisucham ala'ir. You have to travel carefully. Don't travel in dangerous ways. And number three, he says, don't start fighting with each other along the way to figure out, was it right to sell Yosef, was it wrong to sell Yosef, were we justified in what we did, were we not? Don't start getting involved in the whole discussion. What God did is the right thing, and what happened ended up being good, and don't start fighting about it now. There's no point in fighting about it. And I think when we go away on vacation, it's something for us to think about all three pshatim and Rashi. Number one, Al tisaske b'dvar halacha. Sometimes when we take time off to be with our families and to be with our spouses or to be with our children, so we get involved in our own dvar halacha. Either we're very involved in learning, which happens sometimes, or we're very involved in our business, which is our dvar halacha, or we're very involved in our emails and we're involved in our things and we're not paying attention to the family members that are with us. So that's number one. Yosef tells us, Al tisaske b'dvar halacha. When you're going and you're taking time off to be with your family and shut everything else out and allow yourself to spend time with those who want to spend time with you. Number two, don't do anything dangerous. That's what Yosef HaTzadik says. Don't start taking big jumps and big leaps and coming into a city when it's hot, when it's cold, when it's sun, when it's dark. You have to be careful. Sometimes when we go on vacations, we do things that are a little bit hazardous, a little bit dangerous, and we'll drive through the night even though we know that we didn't have sleep, and even though we know that we're overtired and we could get into an accident, and we'll go drive places where we know it's not safe to be driving. So that's something to be kept in mind as well, the second instruction of Yosef HaTzadik. And number three, Yosef tells us, Al tirguzu baderech, don't fight along the way. And even though you have a lot to fight about, and even though you have a lot of times when you have family members that are in too close a proximity to each other for too many days, it gets a little bit difficult. Still, you have to make sure, Al tirguzu baderech, don't start fighting about, did we take the right trip, did we not take the right trip, are we staying in the right rooms, in the wrong rooms, in the right hotels, the wrong hotels, did we plan properly, did we not? These are the three very good advice that Yosef gives all of us when we plan our vacations as well.